We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
We're talking today with author and teacher C.D. Wright, particularly about her book, One with Others, a little book of her days. Carolyn, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you. Thank you for calling.
We're talking with you in your home in Providence, where you're a professor at Brown University. And this book, you have this subtitle, A Little Book of Her Days, and then inside this book, you refer to it as not a work of history, and you say that, let me see if I find the right words here, you say it's a report full of holes. It's a welter of associations, and later you say it's your own footnote to the civil rights movement. Why are you so modest?
Well, the literature around civil rights is pretty extensive at this point, and also there's a pretty eloquent record. And I just felt like I needed to add something. Maybe not an afterword, but I had to add the story of a friend of mine, or a piece of her story.
And it's a wonderfully told story. I was just captivated by your book. I've read it through only once and started it in again. And I have an uncorrected proof that your publisher sent me. I'm so grateful for that. Has the book actually been published by now?
It is out now.
It is out.
It
great.
Is, yes.
So readers can find C.D. Wright, One with Others. You say it's about a friend of yours. Tell us about V and how she got her nickname.
Well, V was just a one letter for her last name, but it was also at the point at which my friends and I met her. She had just finished Thomas Pynchon's V, and so we just tagged it to her. And I met her when I was 17. She was about in her mid-30s at that time.
And how did you meet her?
I met her through a college friend who lived next door to her. And my college friend, I said, she said she wanted me to meet this person. And I said, who is this person? And she said, she's my show and tell. So she was, everyone gets to meet a few people that they're perpetually grateful to have come into contact with, and she was my person.
And you do say, you do give her name in the book?
I don't give her, well, I give her name, yes, I give her name in the footnotes, but I sort of underplay her, her name. I use just her initial in the book.
I was particularly interested in the choices you made in creating this wonderful piece, and that was one of them. You explained that some names were changed or omitted because it's an interpretation that you have given this bit of history in the civil rights movement. But if one reads carefully, you can find out pretty much where this happens and who the people are. Why did you make that choice?
I was conflicted, actually. At first, I changed all of the names, and then I changed all the names back to actual names. And then I eventually mostly suppressed the names, except I acknowledge people in the footnotes.
Yes.
But I also, because I took liberties, there were definitely fictional elements in the telling of it.
How do you describe what this book is? I've quoted several things you put in writing in the book itself, but when your friends asked you what kind of a project were you working on, what did you tell them?
Well, I tell them that I was writing a tribute to a friend of mine who participated in some activity. Rockies and her hometown in the Arkansas Delta in the late 60s, and that she paid a price for it, but she had no regrets about doing it, despite the price she paid. And she, because I came from the other side of Arkansas, which was mostly, almost exclusively white at that time, it was sort of like she played the part I would have played in my imagination had I been from the Delta. So I had to see it through her eyes and tell it through her eyes.
Listeners to this program are, since this is a regional NPR station, are mainly in Illinois and Indiana. Of course, we have listeners via their computers and podcasts and so forth, literally hundreds of thousands a month, but many of them may not know the layout of Arkansas, and I happen to have a state map in front of me. And you're describing, when you talk about the Arkansas Delta, the part along the east side that borders on Memphis, Tennessee, and then where you came from over in the Harrison area, that's called the Arkansas Ozarks, is that correct?
Right, uh-huh. Right. It's in a very old, low mountain range, hill people, and the part that my friend was from is the Mississippi, you know, is bordered by the Mississippi River, the Arkansas Delta. I mean, that's the eastern border of Arkansas, is the Mississippi River.
And you mentioned that at the time in the 60s when these events you describe so well take place, that the population of the state, if I understood you correctly, was maybe over 60% African American, black?
That part of the state.
That was. Part of the state, okay.
Right.
All right.
And probably still is, uh-huh. At least that.
My wife and I were taking a trip to visit a college friend of mine, a doctor in Hot Springs, just a month and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we were driving down I-55 through the Arkansas Delta, and we were going to need to stop somewhere overnight, and I wasn't sure we could make the West Memphis area, and so I had stopped in a gas station and just asked someone there, he happened to be a white man, you know, I think we could make it as far as Osceola. might there be a place we could stay there? And you laugh, but I had no idea that that was an odd question. And it turns out that that's, I think, an all-black town.
You know, I call it Osceola, and I've actually
Osceola?
Never been to Osceola.
Okay.
But it very well may be. I don't know.
The man I spoke with said, well, I think there may be a place you could stay there, but I could tell from his reaction there was something odd about the situation. But that part of Arkansas continues to be very poor, and I don't know, you know, the statistics, but clearly overwhelmingly African American at this point.
And right. Well, the Arkansas Delta was very rich for some people for a long time.
Yes.
And the Ozarks were very poor. That situation is somewhat reversed.
The plantation owners did well, of course.
The plantation owners did well, but the plantations are all now part of large corporate farms.
Right.
And much of the land has been played out, and much of the rivers have been silted up. So they're no longer either recreational or a source of food supply for anyone. So, and there's no manufacturing to speak of in the eastern part of the state. So it's quite depressed at this point, whereas the Ozarks has a number of Fortune 500 companies, big poultry industry, some high-tech industry, H.L. Hunt, et cetera, so that situation is kind of really reversed in terms of poverty.
Professor, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's very seriously depressed area now.
Yes. Professor Wright, you teach at Brown University in Providence, You've received numerous honors, MacArthur Grant, your MacArthur Fellow. You're a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. You've received a number of honors for your teaching and for your 10 books. You've already published some poetry, some prose. Is this book poetry? Is this book prose? How do you answer that question?
Well, whatever it is that I write, I come to the page as a poet, and the form it takes is informed more by poetry than it is by anything else. Whether the result of that is proper poetry, I couldn't say. Poetry is changing all the genres, or kind of shifting inside their frames and crossing outside of their frames. And so I guess the correct term is that it's a hybrid text.
And we can say that it has been nominated for a National Book Award this year in the category of poetry. So some people feel that it fits in that category at least, maybe others as well.
That's true. I'm quite comfortable in that category.
Uh-huh. And you'll find out very soon or maybe you've heard already.
No, I've already found out. I was a finalist, but my book did not win the National Book Award.
But you are one of the five finalists.
Right.
Which is quite an honor.
Yes.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were doing sort of the investigative reporter task, talking to people who had experienced these events in Arkansas during the Civil Rights Movement, you say you did a lot of it by phone. You also visited the areas.
Uh-huh.
You talk about how frightened people were still to talk with you.
I think people, it wasn't so much frightened, but I think people felt it brought it all back very vividly. And so some people actually had been traumatized by those events, and some people had been hurt, you know, deep in their psyches. And some people were still mad. Other people had definitely moved on. So it was a mash, you know. And some people were also very wary of just talking to a stranger about things that had taken place in their town. You know, they also felt protective not only of themselves and their family and their privacy, but also of their place.
When I go back and visit friends in North Carolina, where we spent a number of years, sometimes my Southern accent comes back. Did yours?
It usually does. In fact, I'm surprised you don't hear it now.
A little bit.
It was never a genuine Southern accent. It was more of a hillbilly accent.
Tell us a little bit about your own history growing up in Arkansas, and where did you go to school, and how did you get inspired to become a writer and teacher?
I went to public schools in the Ozark, small town public schools and state schools. My father was a judge. My mother was a court reporter. We always had books. There weren't a lot of diversions in the town I grew up in, but we always had books. My father was a great reader, and I kind of followed in that path of really loving to read. So it wasn't inevitable that I would become a writer, but it was inevitable that I would do something with words. And my friend, who is the protagonist of this book, was one of the people who made literature very vivid to me. She was a totally self-educated person, but she had read more than anyone I'd ever met. And it was all as though all of the characters and the language of these books, these were her familiars. So they dropped into the context of an ordinary conversation very fluently, and that was very impressive to me.
Where did you go after public high school?
I went to a university in the Arkansas Delta for a year, and then a university in the Missouri, and then I ended up at the University of Memphis. And then eventually I went to graduate school at the University of Arkansas.
In Fayetteville?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yes.
And did you go into teaching right away or concentrate on writing, or did you have to make a living other ways?
I made a meager living teaching poetry in the schools for about 5 years after I graduated.
Uh-huh.
And eventually I moved to San Francisco, where I worked at the Poetry Center at San Francisco State. And when I got my first fellowship, I moved to Mexico. It was $10,000. I quit my job. I thought I was rich.
What was your first published work?
It was a chapbook called All a Breath of Loving.
Remind our listeners what a chapbook is, if they don't know.
It's just a small collection of poems or prose. It's usually under 40 pages. I'm not sure what the actual number is that makes it exactly a chapbook, but uh-huh. It's usually a short book.
We're talking with C.D. Wright, that's spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, mainly about her new book, One with Others, which is a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry, published by Copper Canyon Press. One with Others, a little book of her days, about a friend of hers, a teacher who influenced her a great deal, who was active in the civil rights movement in Arkansas. Listeners are encouraged to give us a call. Perhaps you're listening online, in which case use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of our station here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, you're encouraged to call us on several local lines. 333-9455 will get you on the air with our guest, Carolyn Wright. When I was reading your book, I was struck by several references to religion, and this is a program that deals often with spirituality and ethics and religious themes, and of course, the whole book deals with a very important ethical value issue, the civil rights movement, equality for all people, justice, and the examples you give of injustice and cruelty and some pretty horrible things are, of course, not limited to the South. I was struck when I read in your book that the town you grew up in was a sundown town where Africans, Americans, blacks needed to be gone by sundown. They could work there during the day for white people, but they had to be gone by sunset. And in a recent book called Sundown Towns, the author found to his surprise that there were more sundown towns in places like Illinois and Indiana than anywhere in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Ku Klux Klan that you make reference to in your book began in Indiana. So this is relevant for many parts of the country and not just Arkansas.
That's certainly true. My town had a couple of racial cleansings at the turn of the 20th century.
Early 1900s, yes.
Right, very early 1900s. So by the time I was living there in the 50s, there were no black people whatsoever.
At all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The place of religion in the civil rights movement is interesting, and in your book, let me quote from one passage on page 27 where you say these sorts of problems, they entailed the complicity of the leaders of the faithful who are obliged to advance this doctrine, segregation, as the word of the Almighty, some of whom probably are believers in this malevolent reading, while others sign on for efficiency's sake and others by dint of intimidation. I've certainly I certainly know what that feels like. I'm a retired pastor, and I know the pressures on pastors to adopt the values of their congregation is intense.
Yes, I'm afraid it is. In that particular town, there were no white pastors who took a stand. At least they didn't take an honorable stand. And I'm sure they would have lost their parish instantly if they had, but at any rate, they didn't take that step. My friend was Catholic. She played cards with the priest. I don't know if they taught politics.
Or religion.
Mm-hmm.
you quote her at one point on page 35, and you say, if religion is the opiate of the masses, fundamentalism is the amphetamine.
That was one of her expressions, right?
Did you ever hear her say that? Or
did
she write
hear
that?
Her say that.
Okay.
Right.
And would she tend to repeat things at various
Not
times?
Not really. Or? Actually, she had a very wide-ranging field of conversation. It was very literary. She was also interested in film. She was interested in art, and she was vehemently interested in justice. She was quite unstinting about that. It was not a point of compromise for her.
Uh-huh. I thought in terms of the style of your book, that the repetitions that you used were very effective. The images, the phrases that would come back in very surprising ways and in new contexts as the reader goes through the book.
Mm-hmm.
I found that to work very well.
I'm glad. I wanted it to sing, you know, not just to tell a plotting tale, but I wanted to go for the music in it also. And I knew that the music was there.
I think it does sing. I've asked you if you'd pick out a passage or two to read for our listeners, since the book is just barely out and most listeners will not have found it, even though we've been promoing this interview for a week. Tell us, have you picked out something you would care to share over the air?
This is actually very close to the end. It's not exactly summing up, but it is kind of a reflection on what's been written up to that point. But it is the author's voice at this point. For me, it has always been a series of doors. If one is open precipitously, a figure is caught bolting from bed. If another, a small table, a list of demands on school paper. If another, a child on the linoleum saying she wants a white doll. A woman sitting on a bed holding a folded flag, a shelf of trophies behind her head. An ironing board, bottle of bourbon on the end. Sewing machine on a porch. To walk down the road without fear, to sit in a booth and order a sweet soft drink, to work at the front desk, to be referred to as gentleman, to swim in the pool, to sit in the front row and watch Run Wild, Run Free, next week, Death of a Gunfighter, to make your way to the end of the day with both eyes in your head. Nothing is not integral. You want to illumine what you see. Fear reflected off an upturned face. Those walnuts turning black in the grass. It is a relatively stable world, gentle reader. But beyond that door, it defies description.
A portion from One with Others, read to us by the author C.D. Wright. Carolyn Wright is a professor at Brown University and author of 10 books. This last one I just mentioned, a finalist for the National Book Award this year in the category of poetry. Although I hate to mention that because some people are so afraid of poetry, and this is such an easy book to read, to be pulled into, and it tells such a good story, and the characters are so vivid. I almost didn't want to even mention the word.
I sometimes go out of my way to avoid it myself, even though I'm actually proud of poetry.
Sure.
And I've noticed that we continue to keep on keeping on.
Yes.
But people are afraid of it. It's not taught, or it's taught badly. And I think people don't have any, a lot of people don't have any sense of just how extensive the range of poetry is.
Right.
You know, a lot of levels of expression there. You can find very obtuse poetry, and you can find very accessible poetry, and you can find very inventive poetry, and it creates a very interesting cosmology.
You referred in the passage you just read for us to the incident about calling someone a gentleman. Would you mind recounting that? I don't want to in any way spoil people's appreciation for the book when they read it, but is that an incident you could tell about?
I think so. In the context of the story, my friend was called to testify about an accident that she hadn't actually witnessed, but she pointed to the man who had been in the accident. It was a one-person accident. Pointed to the man in the courtroom and couldn't remember his name and referred to him as a gentleman. And the attorney went sort of ballistic at this black man being called a gentleman.
And your friend V is white.
Is white, right?
As you are.
Yes. So everyone sort of, the whole proceeding sort of came to a standstill since this man was apoplectic around this having been given a courtesy title, and my friend V had to just be excused from the stand since no one could continue at that point.
And as you describe her in your book, she had a good temper herself, and I'm sure was perhaps swearing?
Well, not in the courtroom, no.
Oh, okay.
No, she had a good sense of decorum. She had a very strong sense of outrage also.
And that comes through vividly in your book. We can't use some of... We can't read all of your book on the air, let me put it that way.
Right.
But there's some wonderful conversations that happen that are very true to life.
She could be very scandalous, but she had actually beautiful manners.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Tell us about the incident at the swimming pool. It forms such a centerpiece for the story. From the image on the cover on through, but tell our listeners what happened, just basically historically, if you don't mind.
Well, it was an occasion where the students from the black high school had gone to the white high school and locked arms and sang one of the, you know, sort of iconic civil rights songs, like A Tree Planted by the Water. And they were eventually arrested for not moving. And they were taken in trucks. They were driven around for some hours and then taken in trucks to the drained swimming pool.
In sealed trucks, you mentioned.
To the swimming pool, which had been drained for the season, and it was presumably the public pool, but it was for whites only. And they were held there. By day, by night, they were moved into the Civic Center, as I understand. So that was a pretty horrific scene. This went on for several days. Several African-American farmers who owned their own land posted bond. And children. Some of the kids were, you know, quite upset by this. Parents were beside themselves. And that pool was eventually closed. In fact, I don't think it ever reopened after that. There was a claim that there were cracks in the pool or something. It would be too expensive to repair. So they filled it in and paved it over and made a parking lot of it. But the photo on the cover is of the pump house, which they did not tear down. It's kind of overgrown, and you wouldn't notice it unless you knew that that's where the pool had been.
When I was reading the book, I didn't understand the cover photograph, of course, at the beginning, and then when it finally became clear what that was, it was very moving. And you have, at least in the uncorrected proof copy I have, the photograph appears at the end of the book as well.
It does, yes.
And kind of frames the story in a good way. Let me read one more section where you refer to religion in relation to the movement. On page 67, you say there's the consolation of religion, whereas the promise cannot be broken if it applies only to the hereafter and thereafter, whereas herein things can remain in whatever order the ones with the most money and the most ammo say they shall stand. Very telling irony there, I think.
Right. I can't say. The incidents that started a lot of the actions in that town at that time were started when a minister who was also a teacher was fired.
From his teaching job. Yes.
So the black ministry was quite involved in all of the stuff that was happening then, but they didn't get a lot of help from the other side of the aisle.
And in fact, even opposition.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with C.D. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, author of One with Others, A Little Book of Her Days, her account of incidents in the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, and the place of her friend, one of her teachers, in that movement. We'll be getting back to this interview in just a few seconds, but let me remind listeners, you may call in with questions or comments, talk with our guest today, Professor Wright, 333-9455 if it's a local call in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area. If it's long distance, perhaps you're listening live on your computer at will.illinois.edu and then /AM. If it's a long distance call, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll be talking with Elizabeth Campbell Buckley, a mezzo-soprano and choral conductor, and with Pastor John Sutherland about a new Bach cantata that will be performed in December here in Champaign-Urbana. On December 5th, our guest is Courtney Eccles. We'll be talking about education and advocacy, particularly concerns of an organization that works for social justice, particularly in Springfield, Illinois. Then December 12th, our guest is another author, Frances Larson. We'll be talking with her live from Durham, England. She's going to stay up late into the night to be able to talk with us on December 12th. And then December 19th, Joanne Fong will be talking about having gone from being a fashion designer to the pulpit as a pastor. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Well, let's get back to our guest, C.D. Wright. Professor Wright, how do you like teaching?
I like teaching. I've been at Brown University since the early 80s. It's been a very good position for me. My students are quite wonderful. I have good colleagues. It's a good environment in which to work and to teach and to keep my own chops up by staying abreast of the kinds of writing that are happening now. It's good. It's a good exchange between writing and teaching. There are times when, of course, it can tap you out, but there are other times when it nourishes you.
When you got the MacArthur Grant, which is a bit more than that $10,000 you got early in your career, did that give you an opportunity to take a sabbatical for a while and concentrate only on writing, or did you choose to keep teaching the same way you had been?
Well, I did take time off. I took a year off, and then I took a reduced load for 5 years. So it bought me quite a bit of time, finally.
When were you named a MacArthur Fellow?
When was I named a MacArthur Fellow? It just ended last year.
Okay. I was curious
if it was around 2005, I guess.
So it might have been helpful as you were doing research for One with Others?
I think at that point I was working on a prison book.
Oh.
With photographer Deborah Luster.
In Louisiana?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the title of that book?
Was One Big Self. And the title of the photographic edition was One Big Self, Prisoners of Louisiana. And the text edition was One Big Self, An Investigation. And it was focused on three prisons in Louisiana.
To what do you attribute your concern for justice?
I think it was just family values and also reading a lot. I think books can feed your thirst for justice. And my parents had a pretty strong sense of justice. My brother did also.
Your father a judge?
My father was a judge, and he came from a very, very poor family, and he was a very bookish man from the country. So I think it was from my family, you know, my family and the things that I read that informed me.
What books particularly stand out in your memory as formative?
Well, I think I would have to skip to later in terms of thinking really. Probably Mark Twain when I was a child. When I was in my early 20s, the poet Frank Stanford, who was also from Arkansas and Memphis, his books were very influential for me. He was a young poet my age, who already had a very developed lexicon for the things he was thinking and feeling and his own preoccupations. And that was very important to me, to realize that I could do that. Maybe I couldn't do it as well as he could do it, but I could do that.
Frank Stanford died tragically young, but you have a quotation from him in your book, "I want people of 27 languages walking back and forth saying to one another, 'Hello, brother, how's the fishing?' And when they reach their destination, I don't want them to forget if it was bad." The battlefield where the moon says, "I love you," a quotation you have in your book, One
right.
with Others. When you were reading Mark Twain, how old were you?
I was probably in my teens when I read Mark Twain.
His autobiography just came out this year, published at his insistence 100 years after his death.
I think that's a pretty good rule.
Are you writing one?
No, I'm not.
When you pick a topic for a project, do you start with an image in your head, with a location, with people, with words? And what are you working on now?
It depends. I've worked with this photographer for a number of years, and sometimes she suggests a project, and I get involved in it reluctantly, and then I get quite caught up in it. This particular project was just because my friend died, and I wanted to not to forget her, and I wanted other people to know a little bit about someone that I thought was worth remembering.
Your friend died in 2004, and it was then you began working on One With Others?
It was a little after that. Uh-huh. I was finishing other things at the time.
And is it fair to ask you what you're working on now, or are you one of the writers who would rather not, which is fine?
Well, I think I'm not yet. I think I'm going to write a book that's sort of a companion to one that I wrote some years ago called Cooling Time, an American Poetry Vigil, which was a prose work, and I think I'm going to write a companion work to that, which is sort of narrative and about poetry and poetics and other things, personal life, domestic life. And I think I want to work on a project about Vic Chestnut, who is a singer, songwriter, recording artist from Athens, Georgia, who died last Christmas. And that would be a multimedia project if I actually can pull it off. So I'd be working with artists in other media.
Tell us that name again.
Vic Chestnut. Recording artist.
Well, people are probably going to YouTube right now to hear that, so.
I hope so.
Music plays an important part in this book, One With Others. You've already referred to the song, Like a Tree Planted by the Waters, I Shall Not Be Moved, that one of the civil rights anthems.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been interested in music as well as poetry all of your life?
I'm interested in music. I probably know more about visual art than I do music, but I am interested in music. And if my project is very located in a place, which it often is, then I usually tune in to the music from that place. I did, at one point, a reader's map of Arkansas, and I also did a reader's map of Rhode Island, which is, in both cases, they're kind of descriptions of the state before their states. With Arkansas, the map began with the DeSoto Chronicles and went through to the present. And one of the things I found in the Arkansas map that some of the defining writers were songwriters, often down-home blues writers, but country writers, writers of shape note music, and in Rhode Island, it was people authoring religious tracts who kind of define the state.
You refer to several interesting people in your book, among them Al Green.
Al Green, Johnny Cash.
Sonny Liston. All from Arkansas?
All of those people were from the Arkansas Delta.
The Man in Black.
The Man in Black, yes.
You represent the time so well, as well as the place. When you were doing research, how did you recover that?
Well, I read a couple of shelves of civil rights books. There were a couple of books that were quite critical for that. One was American Congo by Nan Woodruff, and then the Taylor Branch trilogy about the King years. So there was a lot of reading, but I also read a lot of local newspapers, which was kind of excruciating. You know, it was sort of old microfiche reading, but I mostly enjoyed the ads.
Yes, the editorials would have been heartbreaking.
Yeah, they were.
Right.
But they gave you, newspapers are so various. There's so much, many different kinds of material in newspapers, and they definitely give you flavor of the time. Even bad newspapers.
Right. We have some examples of those locally. even in a college town. When we're when you were reliving these civil rights days, tell us about how this march, why the march that takes place in this book, I guess is representative of its time. I certainly thought it was.
It was originally a march against fear duplicating, sort of, or replicating James Meredith's march against fear. It was in the end called the Poor People's March. But it was to demonstrate that, really, that people could walk down the road all the way from West Memphis to Little Rock unarmed and unharmed. There were more state troopers than there were marchers, finally. And my friend V was one of the marchers or driving the water truck.
It was a huge distance.
It is a long distance. And it was also summer, and it was the Delta.
Very hot in the Arkansas Delta.
Yeah, it was sweltering.
So from the bridge?
From the, not quite the bridge, but from a spot down in downtown West Memphis, they stepped off.
And you describe feelings, sights, conversations, accusations.
Right. Yes, there was one town that deputized all the men in the town because the marchers were going to pass through.
All the white men.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, there were only about 7 marchers, you know.
Unarmed.
Right.
What lasting impact has all of this, not only in Arkansas, but the civil rights movement in this country, to your students today? You're dealing with young adolescents, older adolescents, young adults. What do they know of this?
I don't know what they know of this. I don't know. Certainly their parents know, but even their parents at this point are mostly younger than I am. So we're talking a couple of generations removed from this, and I'm sure some of them are concerned about this or informed about this, but it's not usually the subject of the course, so I don't always have an opportunity to have conversations about that time.
How diverse is your student body who take your classes at Brown?
It's pretty diverse. It's just, you know, I have graduate students and undergraduate students, and it's a pretty international school. And of course, we have a black president who is from a sharecropper family in Texas. She's a terrific president. It's a very diverse school, really, more than any school I've ever been to, except San Francisco State when I worked there. It's very international.
I mentioned earlier some of the choices you made in the way you wrote this book. I was curious about another couple things. You chose to, even in quotes, when someone was saying something particularly nasty to the black folks, you say the N-word and you put it in brackets. Tell me about that choice.
One of the books I read was a book called, what is it? It was called Nigger, The Strange Career of a Word. I'm sure I've got a list of the books in the back, but I can't remember now the author of that book, but that title also comes from The Strange Career of James Crow, an earlier book by an Arkansas historian. And I just decided after reading that book that I would never use that word.
Uh-huh.
And that I would call attention to it by using N-word every time that word would have been said.
I thought it worked very well, and it lets the nastiness through, and yet shows your view of that nastiness.
Uh-huh.
Why not parentheses? Why did you choose brackets?
I don't know. It's a strange aesthetic choice. Once I started using the brackets, I liked the way they looked.
Uh-huh.
Thought that they had that they were more emphatic than a parenthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It was visual.
Uh-huh.
And what I thought that it might be doing to the reading of it.
This book is very visual. You said that the visual arts are something you've always been attracted to, interested in. How did that begin in your life?
It didn't begin until I moved to New York City when I was 21, and I had a job as a receptionist at Park Burnett Art Galleries, an art auction house, and I just realized I really liked to look. And I still do. I still really love to look at art. Over the years, I've become more interested in looking at photography than I have the other arts, but I like to look at all of them. And I like museums. I like galleries. I like small museums the best. And I just feel like my own language has been enhanced by a lot of looking and a lot of careful looking, that I have a stronger descriptive sense, but also that I have developed a more acute visual sense that helps me see a little farther than I might otherwise have seen, a little farther into something.
The book that I hold in my hand of yours, One with Others, is printed on very nice paper, archival paper. The type choice is very, print choice is very pleasing. But I was also pleased by the arrangement of your words on the page. I take it you required that.
I did, and we started out, and my press has been very accommodating for me and to present my books in the best possible way.
And you even got to choose the shape of the book, the size of it, I'm guessing?
Well, initially we were thinking about doing a smaller book, more of a paperback type book that you could put in your pocket. And it just didn't quite, it wasn't appropriate for the kinds of lineation I was using and the sentencing I was using and the spacing. It didn't work out. It made it too crowded, and so it ended up with a larger book size, trim size in the end, and it's very handsome.
It is, and I think visually it invites the reader in on almost every page, and the way some things are in caps, the way some of it, the way the things are spaced, often, I don't know what this is, eight spaces between some of the lines and six, and then I think never less than double space, but it's quite inviting. It's a book of 150 pages in the uncorrected proof that I have, at least, and I recommend it to readers. Again, the title, One with Others, A Little Book of Her Days, by C.D. Wright, about a friend of hers, a teacher, who was active in the civil rights movement in Arkansas. We're down to just our last couple minutes, Carolyn. You have humor in this book. Here it is, a serious topic, civil rights, this movement, all this anger and hate and vitriolic words, and yet here you have interspersed wonderfully to represent the time, letters to Dear Abby and answers. Why did you do that?
Well, I like humor. And I think there's room for it in almost every circumstance. And I thought that they relieved the book. And I thought they also set the time and gave you another kind of context for how people you know, what people's perceptions were like at that time. You know, one of the Dear Abby letters is a woman writing and asking about whether she has to continue to iron her husband's boxer shorts that she didn't mind at first, but now they had several kids and it was becoming, you know, sort of seemed like an unnecessary task. And, you know, Abby wrote back and said, you know, you're wasting more time whining about this. Just iron his shorts. You know, those. So they were very telling.
Both the question and the answer.
Right.
Yes.
And they were also quite, they were funny.
Sure.
You know, they were, you know, they said something not so great about how things were at the time. But I found that also when I was working on the prison book that Louisiana humor is the absolute best I've ever heard, and there was no point in excluding it in a maximum security prison where people could just be, you know, knee-slapping funny.
I'll read another of your Dear Abby quotations. These are quotations?
They are quotations.
Yeah, they are, okay. Dear Abby, I am 11 years old, but I know all the facts of life because I live in a dirty neighborhood. My problem is that in our family, we get pregnant quick. My sister got pregnant when she was 16, just by sitting next to a boy in church. Can this be? Abby responds, Dear young miss, no, somebody must have moved.
Right.
That's a great selection.
I think I kept a spelling in that, too, pregnant.
You did. Yeah. I tried to read it that way, but I have,
yes, I know. It's so
I have a bit of a stuffy nose today. So. Well, let me thank you for being on the air with us for this whole hour, and I know with your busy time, it's very valuable, and I thank you for sharing with listeners in the Midwest and for people who listen to the podcast of this program in the years to come, this interview. We've been talking with C.D. Wright, Carolyn Wright, a professor at Brown University, a recipient of the several awards, perhaps most notable, she's a MacArthur Fellow. She's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, author of 10 books, the most recent of which is One with Others, a little book of her days about a friend of hers in Arkansas during the Civil Rights Movement. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And I'm looking forward to interviewing next week two folks dealing with a musical theme, a new Bach cantata. We'll be learning about that from choral conductor Elizabeth Campbell Buckley and Lutheran pastor John Sutherland. That's November 28, right after Thanksgiving, here on Keeping the Faith. Coming up in December, Courtney Eccles from Chicago will be talking with us about her work doing advocacy and education in the General Assembly in Springfield, Illinois, on behalf of folks concerned with this, with progressive values. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
Thank you.
You're welcome.